Welcome to Just Ask, the podcast of the Hive Collective, a digital health platform built to empower women to make educated and informed decisions about their health. I'm your co-host, Dr. Heather Quayle, a leading women's and gender-related nurse practitioner. We provide answers to the questions you may not know how to ask by interviewing experts in nursing, medicine, sexual health, and wellness. We started in 2020 with myself and colleague Dr. Tara Thompson, pharmacist, and now welcome our co-host and leading women's health expert and nurse practitioner, Jackie Piasta. This is a safe space where no question is off limits, and we advocate and encourage listeners to just ask their most intimate questions and to break down the barriers of embarrassment and taboo.
I'm Jackie Piasta, your other co-host and fellow Queen Bee of the Hive. Each month, we bring on a new guest that is an expert and healthcare innovator in their respective field. As the healthcare landscape rapidly evolves, we are excited to be on the cutting edge and have decided to evolve the podcast into the Hive Collective, a space that seeks to equip you to better navigate your health journey. To learn more about our new and exciting platform, check out our mission, vision, values, and initiatives as we discuss our rebrand in Season 4, Episode 1. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We're excited you're here and hope you enjoy our show.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Just Ask podcast. We are so excited today to have Dr. Simon here. He is such a fantastic individual. Heather and I are so pumped that he's on our show today. And we know that he's going to give so much helpful information. Our listeners are just going to walk away knowing just the wealth in the fountain. So without further ado, I want to introduce Dr. James Simon. He is a Chicago native and attended Rush Medical College. He began his career following an OBGYN residency and a reproductive endocrinology and infertility fellowship at Harbor-UCLA Medical Center. In the early 80s, Dr. Simon's focus was on assisted reproduction, where he furthered both clinical and basic science research at the Jones Institute for Reproductive Medicine. He was then recruited to Georgetown University School of Medicine as their division director, reproductive endocrinology and infertility. In 2004, Dr. Simon married the Women's Health Research Center to his private practice to form the Women's Health and Research Consultants, which is located in Washington, D.C., and that's where he continues to see patients and conduct clinical research. They now have 11 staff members, and many of them working for Dr. Simon for more than 20 years. The practice focuses on reproductive endocrinology and infertility, and provides a deep understanding of just how profoundly infertility can adversely affect sexual intimacy. Dr. Simon in 2017 brought Dr. Rachel Rubin, a board-certified urologist and subspecialty trained sexual medicine practitioner, into the practice, forming Intim Medicine Specialists. And we'll talk to Dr. Simon afterwards. He'll let us know how to contact him. Dr. Simon has a really interesting overriding philosophy. It's that the patient nearly can always tell the clinician what's wrong. He or she may not know what it is or what it's called, but the thoughtful practitioner who really knows how to listen with a sensitive, scientific, and knowledgeable ear can figure it out and design a plan of treatment. It's sort of what he calls the "you talk, I'll listen, we plan together" philosophy. Dr. Simon has a ton of accolades. I could literally sit here. He had more than 400 clinical research trials, grants, and scholarships, written some amazing papers, been on some amazing boards. He was past president of NAMS, which is the North American Menopause Society, and also the immediate past president of ISHWISH, which is the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. We talk a lot about that organization here on our podcast. He has a strong career-long commitment to the prevention of disease and advancing women's health, serves on the board of trustees for breast health, menopause health, sexual health, and we're just absolutely thrilled to have him here. He is a dad, he is a husband, he is a grandfather. Dr. Simon, thank you so much for being here.
Tara, it's really my pleasure. Thank you and Heather very much for this opportunity. And I look forward to clearing the air on a lot of issues, hormonal, sexual, and other.
Absolutely. You are a mentor to me. So I almost feel like I'm not worthy. And I'm just so thrilled to have you. I've looked up to you for quite a long time. So to have you here and talk candidly with our listeners it means a lot to me as a clinician. I kind of laugh when Tara talked a little bit about your bio of you talk, I listen, but I think that I listen to you and I could listen to you over and over and over again. So we are just so grateful to have you. Our listeners have no idea. So I could talk to you all day. So let's just dive in because I know it's going to be a quick spiel. I want to talk about the Women's Health Initiative, menopause, hormones, and all of it. So help me help our listeners understand this whole Women's Health Initiative and why women stop taking hormones.
So Heather, the Women's Health Initiative is and was a very important series of studies. It's not just a hormone study, although that's obviously what we're talking about today. The late Dr. Bernadine Healy, who was the head of the National Institutes of Health, managed to get our elected officials to set aside a couple of billion dollars, that's billion with a B, back in the very early 1990s. And that back then, $1 billion was really in a lot of money, to do one group of studies called the Women's Health Initiative, because it was very clear that women's health and women's aging health had been under-investigated and underfunded for some time, with some notable exceptions like breast cancer, which got a lot of funding for a long time. One of the studies that we're going to talk about in more depth was part of that Women's Health Initiative, and it's the hormone therapy studies. There were two of them done in parallel, one in women who had hysterectomies and took estrogen by itself, and one that was in naturally menopausal women, and they took estrogen and a synthetic form of progesterone for an extended period of time. Both of those studies were double-blind, randomized, and placebo-controlled, and those are all good descriptions of good study design.
Exactly.
To jump to the conclusion, and then we'll tease out some of the important issues. In 2002, about a decade after the study was designed, the part of the study looking at naturally menopausal women on estrogen and synthetic progestogen published their results. And those results were broadcast to the world in a very strange way. They came out in a press conference rather than in a scientific journal. And because the world had never seen the results, only heard about them in the press conference, the press itself drove the knowledge and understanding before the scientific community really had a chance to examine the actual data and the actual findings. And unfortunately, I think the messages that were being put forward were garbled at best, misleading and incorrect at worst. And I think women's health was not well served somewhere in between. 2 years later, 2004, the other study, the one that involved surgically menopausal women, that is women who had the hysterectomy before becoming menopausal, came out, and the results were very poorly publicized, in fact, and they were very different. The results were extremely different, and there might be a number of reasons for that. But the die had been cast, the media had driven the message, the discussion died in 2002, with the end result being hormones are bad for you. The risks of hormones outweigh any benefits. And we now know, some 20 years later, that that's just not the case. And we can tease that out, and I'm sure that Heather has specific questions, but I'm going to give you my really short take, and then we can get into the nitty-gritty. The studies were done on women between age 50 and age 79. So this is a very wide range. And the results on a 50-year-old, that's to say a 50 to 59-year-old, and a 60 to 69-year-old, and a 70 to 79-year-old were very, 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 I can't say enough, very different, with most of the benefits accruing to the women who were in their 50s, who normally would be taking hormones, and most of the risk accruing to women in their 70s, who literally never would have been started on hormones, because most women start on hormones for symptoms. And the women in their 60s were kind of a mixed bag between what we found for women in their 50s and women in their 70s. But the key message is that the results were so bad, that is to say, hormones were so deleterious to women's health if the women started them in their 70s, that the risks did outweigh the benefits that were seen in the women in their 50s. And that's why when all of those women were thrown together, the risks outweighed the benefits. And unfortunately, that's the message that got driven home, in spite of the fact that almost always it's women in their 50s or younger women who use hormones for treating menopausal symptoms. And they have a lot of fear involved in that now that is completely unjustified.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And honestly, like when I think back to the WHI, so I graduated, I'm dating myself here, but I graduated my NP program in 01. And I remember right around that time, this study had come out. And I remember my faculty saying, all right, well, what we got out of this is don't prescribe HRT. We're really not going to get into a lot of menopause, because the answer is when a patient asks you, nope, it's not safe for you. That's what you got to do. And so it makes me think back to, okay, these were back in the early 2000s, and how many women I could have helped over my trajectory as an NP, but just that fear that was put in us as clinicians, you're going to get sued, they're going to die, they're going to stroke. And it's like, it's just, it's so sad that the media can take something and spin it in such a way to now looking at the research and seeing what we have, how much catastrophe have we caused in all those 20 years where they should have been on hormones for people that are now in those, we're in the 50s. It's like, those are the kind of things that go through my mind when I hear you speak on this and I think about where it came and where I started as a clinician.
One of the studies that was put together relatively recently over the last few years by Dr. David Katz and Dr. Philip Sorrell actually demonstrated that in about 10 years, that the women who had hysterectomy and who were denied hormones over the past 10 years, that the Women's Health Initiative results actually caused an excess of more than 50,000 premature deaths.
Yep.
Other studies show that there was a bump in the risk of osteoporosis, fractures, premature cardiovascular disease, not to mention symptoms and broken marriages and other relationships having to do with the adverse effects of missing hormones on mood, behavior, sex, relationships, etc. So it's been a challenge.
It has been a challenge. And I that's part of a big part of our advocacy with this platform is people need to hear it from the experts as yourself, why they need to be talking to their providers, even if their providers are still scared and they're still reading these crazy old research studies. Have patients need to advocate for themselves. Nope, I'm in my early 50s. I want to start on something. This is what I've heard. And it's like, we got a long way to go, but we're starting.
One of the problems, Heather, is that there's an entire generation of practitioners, physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants of all different kinds, who heard it was risky, but more importantly, were never trained how to do it.
Exactly.
And so when a practitioner of any kind hears that something is risky and further doesn't have firsthand experience on how to do it, then their patients are unlikely to get it, even if whatever it is the right thing for them.
Exactly, exactly. And like I said, when I was back in school, it was like, okay, here are the HRTs that we could talk about, hormone replacement therapy, but don't worry about it because you're not going to prescribe them anymore. So it's taken all this time to get back in NAMS and North American Menopause Society for NAMS and all these places, ISHWISH, to tell people it's okay. So I want to now kind of dive in a little bit to tell, first of all, I want you to tell our younger perimenopausal patients why this is the right options for them and why there is safety there. I mean, they still need to be safe and consider risks versus benefits, but why the benefits so outweigh the risks.
So let's talk about something that our younger patients, let's take it even much younger, reproductive age patients know instinctively. They know that breastfeeding is really good for their babies. Okay? Natural breast milk, while not every woman can breastfeed and not every baby has the benefit of being breastfed, in general, we believe that having breast milk and being breastfed by your mother or even a wet nurse, if that happens very often in where you are, Heather, is a good thing. It's a healthy thing for the baby. Well, why do I bring this up? Because we're talking about menopause. Well, the only time in a woman's life when her hormones are the same low level that they are after menopause is when she's breastfeeding, when she's exclusively breastfeeding. And in the context of breastfeeding, those low hormones, those low levels of hormones are actually a good thing. So let's think about that. It's a good thing that Mrs. Smith, and by the way, all my patients are named Smith, but Mrs. Smith is breastfeeding. And it's a good thing that Mrs. Smith might be having some hot flashes or some night sweats or disturbed sleep, because in the context of having a newborn baby that's breastfeeding, her having disturbed sleep might alert her to her baby's crying so that she can get up, get her baby, feed her baby, who maybe needs to be fed every 2 hours. So in that context, having poor sleep might be a good thing for the next generation of humans. Second, if she has dryness, vaginal dryness, or if she has pain with sex, that might not be so good for her boyfriend, husband, father of the baby, but it's good for her not to get pregnant again because she's breastfeeding and that baby needs her undivided attention. And if she were to get pregnant again, she might have an added stress on her body that would be counterproductive both to her and her baby. So these symptoms that I'm mentioning, and there are many, many, many others, those symptoms actually are the same as we have in menopausal women, but they don't stop when the baby gets weaned, they continue in that menopausal woman from age 50 until death. And we need that woman's hormones to be replaced, hormone replacement therapy, just like they are when she stops breastfeeding and her ovaries kick back in and they start making the same hormones we would like to give her in menopause. It's just not that complicated.
Exactly, exactly. But again, it's all the bad stuff that came behind it, where we got to go back and we have to reteach. And forgive me for saying this, but I always say OBGYNs, and I worked for one for years and years, the meat and potatoes of your practice that keeps the lights on is the OB, let's be honest, for most practices. And so they care a lot about, let's bring the OB patients in. And I always say the menopausal patient, we're the lost generation. And, you know, people don't want to deal with it.
It's true. It is undervalued taking care of, I'll say it, older or aging women. It doesn't involve surgery frequently. It doesn't involve large amounts of reimbursement from payers. And there are some things that need to happen in the early menopause so that women can age gracefully. We all like to focus on looking good, feeling good, remaining sexual and youthful. Our society is focused on young women and young men and being youthful and healthy. And one part of that is having one's hormones in a range. They don't have to be in the range of a 20-year-old. But at least in the range of a 35 to 45 year old, so that all the tissues that we like to look good, feel good, and act good remain healthy and vital. And that can be trivial, perhaps, or vain. Like, I don't know any woman that doesn't want to have good skin, hair, and nails. Why not? Right. And let's extend that to a healthy vagina and supported breasts and a good female shape and a normal female body fat distribution. These are all hormonally dependent tissues, and we have the ability to maintain them to a great degree, not perfectly, believe me. You can't fool Mother Nature and you can't prevent aging. And we all live with gravity.
Very much so. Very much so.
I know that one of the things our listeners might not know is that you actually have estrogen receptors on your skin. So estrogen actually has a place there too, whether we know it or not. Dr. Simon, can you talk a little bit about the effects, the long-term effects or the long-term benefits of hormone replacement therapy, specifically the estrogens, but what does it do in the bones, in the heart? Are there benefits there?
Yeah, so this has been a very confusing issue, and I'm glad you brought it up, Tara. So one of the universal and non-controversial issues is that hormones prevent bone loss. And by preventing bone loss, ultimately prevent fractures and the appearance of that little old lady who's all bent over with fractures in her spine, or who has a risk or an actual hip fracture. Now, let's go back to my breastfeeding woman for a minute, back to that 25-year-old or 30-year-old who's breastfeeding her baby. Well, we all know that she's making milk for that baby, and that milk has to have calcium in it. You know, we drink calcium as older adults, drink milks to get calcium or have dairy products to get calcium. And it is that calcium that comes out of a breastfeeding woman's bones that goes into the breast milk that makes the skeleton of her breastfeeding baby strong and healthy as it grows. Well, the problem is that the calcium coming out of the skeleton after menopause without hormone therapy, without hormone replacement therapy, it just continues to come out of the bones, and the bones get weaker and weaker until they break. And it's very clear that hormone therapy, as long as a woman is on it, can prevent bone loss and fractures. We also have very good other non-hormonal medications that work to prevent bone loss and prevent fractures in women who cannot or will not use hormones. But the skeleton is a very, very sensitive organ to the loss of estrogen after menopause, or for that matter, the loss of estrogen when breastfeeding.
Absolutely. And I don't think we cannot talk about, obviously, my favorite topic to focus on in our Just Ask is around the sexual component. I can't do a podcast without talking about it every single time. So can we jump in and really talk about the GSM, genitourinary symptoms of menopause, and why these hormones are so important for vaginal health, sexual health, vulvar health? That's kind of what a lot of our listeners come to listen to, is those pieces. They're too afraid to ask their providers and maybe have some advocacy on why they need to be advocating that they need them.
So this is very important. So sex is a complicated phenomenon. We like to talk about sex as a biopsychosocial phenomenon. It brings all of those elements to it. On the biological part of sex, hormones, the same hormones we've been talking about, estrogen, progesterone, testosterone in women, drive function as it relates to sex. They drive function in a couple of different ways. So most of your listeners know that if they're having regular, natural menstrual cycles, that at certain parts of their menstrual cycle, they're interested in sex. They may have spontaneous sexual thoughts or fantasies, or desire to engage with their partner, or they may have no partner and they desire to engage with themselves.
Absolutely.
And that usually occurs right around the middle of the menstrual cycle, when the estrogen level is peaking, because that's the time of fertility. Mother Nature put into the mix, we want to make babies. Sex means making babies to Mother Nature. And so a rise in those reproductive hormones around the middle of a woman's cycle, menstrual cycle, drives interest in sex. Well, it's the same hormones that drive interest in sex in menopausal women. And we give women those hormones in order to stimulate sexual desire, which is in the brain, toward that end. Now, Heather brought up the question, what about genitourinary syndrome of menopause? And that really means the vulva, the vagina, and the bladder, all of those tissues are highly sensitive to estrogen. In the same way that I brought up, they kind of wither during breastfeeding, they do the same thing after menopause, and they need special attention. Now, you can give them special attention by applying local hormones, which might include estrogen and testosterone, or it might not require any more estrogen and testosterone than is given systemically to stimulate those thoughts in her brain, and just secondarily take care of her vulvo-vaginal symptoms that are related to menopause. It doesn't matter where they come from, but the tissues of the vulva, vagina, clitoris are very, very sensitive, just like the skeleton, to low levels of estrogen and testosterone. And they have a nearly perfect, and I want to emphasize this, nearly perfect memory. So if someone, let's say Mrs. Smith, goes to see Heather and they haven't had sex in a decade and their vaginas or vulvas are 60 years old and haven't seen hormones in a decade or more, they may require some time. They may require some physical therapy, but if they get the right hormones, they have nearly a perfect memory and they will regenerate. I've never seen someone that didn't have surgery. Now, someone cuts out a piece of your body, it doesn't grow back. But if they're naturally just dry and aged with proper attention, both physical attention and hormonal attention, they come back. Nearly perfect memory.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other thing that I definitely want our listeners to hear too, especially with just the estrogen or hormones in the vulvovaginal tissues, they don't have to stop that. Like we keep saying, till death do they part. I hear it over and over, and I want them to hear from the expert. What are your thoughts on that? Can they use it long-term? Should they use it long-term? Is this a forever, at least in the vulvovaginal tissues?
So I think that in general, forever means 1 year at a time. I don't want to predict the way the world will be 30 years from now, largely because I'll probably be dead. But the answer is, I don't want to make my prediction too far in advance. In general, however, women starting on hormones, whether local in their vaginas or on their vulvas, or systemic by pills, patches, pellets, paste, whatever it is, women who are healthy and remain healthy can certainly remain on their hormones for long periods of time, measured in decades. But because those of us who have prescriptive authority are required to refill those prescriptions and check in with our patients on a regular basis, while it may be, in general, as a thought experiment, good for decades, it may need to be adjusted, re-prescribed, modified 1 year at a time. And one shouldn't underestimate the fact that the insurance industry requires that we do prior authorizations or new approvals or new prescriptions, or any number of bureaucratic things to keep Mrs. Smith on whatever she's doing well on for another year or a year after that or a decade.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also important too, like you've touched on things for being on them for a decade and things like that. And that's why it's just important, even for providers that may listen to our podcast, about just going and finding the resources and going and finding the journals and the important things. What are some of the places that are some of your tops that you recommend for any of our providers that listen, that they should be going to and looking at just to educate themselves, especially for people that have been told no, hormones are bad and we want to change this trajectory?
Yeah, so the North American Menopause Society has a lot of resources for practitioners and resources for patients, not the least of which is a find a provider website where individuals who have either become members of the Menopause Society or passed a specific certifying exam on menopause can be identified by patients or other practitioners, by the way, who may need to refer someone in their community or find someone outside their community, and for patients to find someone who can provide them care. So this is a very good resource. In addition, for practitioners who would like to learn the North American Menopause Society annual meeting and postgraduate courses have lots to teach. If it's about hormones and sexual health specifically, the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, or ISHWSH, and the International Society for Sexual Medicine are two additional available resources with tons of online information in both areas. And I will say to Heather's credit, we are working on a patient-facing website for ISHWSH that will have all kinds of peer-reviewed factual information that should be available sometime later this year for women and men who want to know what the latest and greatest is about sexual health and the problems affecting all of us from time to time as it relates to sexual health. And that's coming. And I'm very pleased that Heather's working on it, Tara's working on it, and I'm going to take a little credit for making sure that everybody keeps moving, because I'm the one that beat the society into doing it from the get-go.
So needed, though. So needed. It's kind of how we all aligned forces, but no, it's so needed out there. I'm excited about it. Super.
There are other sources of good information also, Heather, but those I really stick by, because I know what's in their websites. And I would encourage the clinicians who are on this, and I would encourage the patients to encourage their clinicians to become members of the North American Menopause Society or of ISHWSH, and get up to speed, get up to date, even if their training, their formal training, was absent in the areas of menopausal health that Heather and I have been talking about.
Yeah. And I will say, the people that are, especially, I can speak a lot to ISHWSH because we're all involved in it. It's some of the best providers. So it's not this hierarchy of, oh, you're an advanced practice provider, I'm a physician, don't talk to me. I mean, I have met some of the most amazing people in these societies that are willing to help. We have wonderful forums and chats. And that's why I always tell my patients too, if I don't know the answer, I'm going to reach out to my experts and they'll help me answer it. And that's what the beautiful thing is about these societies and people like you, Dr. Simon, that just advocate and you help us younger ones be better for the next generation. So how
and
do
by the way, and by the way, Heather, I get questions that I don't know the answer to, that I cannot find the answer to. And I reach out to all of my colleagues as well to see if they may have heard of it or know something about it. No person can know everything. It's not possible. Absolutely. And so as a community of providers for NAMS and ISHWSH, we bring a lot to the table because we bring a lot to each other.
I wholeheartedly agree. It's a very, it's just a wonderful society. So how do our amazing listeners find you, get more information from you? Just because, like I said, I could talk to you all day long and you have so much to add.
Well, they could come see me, visit their elected officials, their senators and their congressmen. My Washington, D.C. office is called Intim Medicine, I-N-T-I-M, medicine.com. And it's located five blocks from the White House. Yes, that White House. And it's easy to find. On the other hand, they may be able to schedule a counseling session with me on Zoom or FaceTime or any number of the digital platforms. But the answer is I'm happy to try and help them or their practitioners. I get calls from doctors. I've got a whole stack of charts today that I have to deal with, calls from practitioners, both local, national, and international, who have questions because, as I said, not everybody can know anything. So Into Medicine Specialists, Washington, D.C. You can find us online. We have a very extensive website, and I'd be happy to help anyone if they come to D.C. or they want to speak to me. I also have a couple of longstanding practitioners that are with me, Lucy Treen and Carol Mack. I think Carol's been with me for 25 years, Lucy about 30. So we have a nice little team in downtown DC. Happy to help in any way I can.
I can't thank you enough. Thank you so much just for your time, your expertise, and all you do for women's health.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Simon. This is just, it's so helpful. Like Heather said at the very beginning, to hear it from a professional, from a doctor, from an expert in the field. Patients need to hear it there instead of going wherever these Facebook groups or forums or, you know, Google. I mean, it's just very important that we get the message out there. So thank you so much for all you do. For our listeners, thank you for hanging in there with us. I hope you got so much out of Dr. Simon. If you're in the DC area, go by and see him. But thank you guys. And we'll see you next month for our next one.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Just Ask podcast. And thank you for our amazing panelists today and every day. Feel free to contact us publicly or privately with your questions and thoughts. We do not provide medical advice, but we can point you in the right direction and provide resources. You can learn more about the topics we've discussed in this episode by viewing the show notes for this podcast and following us at Just Ask ATL on Facebook and Instagram. Our podcast is available on all of your favorite platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pandora, Google, Amazon, and iHeartRadio. Please make sure you subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. If you found value in this discussion, please share this podcast with friends or leave a rating on iTunes. Thanks again for listening. We can't wait for you to join us for the next show.